Hi everyone, this is Dr. Tony Asher. For Chicago 2024 and the ANS annual meeting, we developed one of the most thematically coherent and content-rich scientific programs ever. We'll specifically be addressing subjects of immense importance to our membership in both science and in our social lives at a pivotal point in our history and in world history. Our AI program in particular will be spectacular. Please join us for a conversation around the things that really matter in your practice and your lives in 2024.
This is the Neurosurgery Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurosurgery Podcast. Here we are with another in-person, live, face-to-face recording from fabulous Las Vegas here at this year's spine section meeting. Dr. Wang, unfortunately, cannot join us for this one, but I am truly excited for the conversation we're about to have. I'm joined by a new friend and old. First, Dr. Anthony DiGiorgio is back with us. He's been on the show a couple times, and now for the first time on the show, Dr. Sanjay Dahl. Dr. Dahl, take a moment, say hello to our audience, introduce yourself.
Thanks, JP, for having me. My name is Sanjay Dahl. I'm Chief of Neurosurgery at Harbor UCLA in Southern California, and excited to be here.
And Dr. DiGiorgio, in case any of our listeners have been slipping and didn't catch your recent appearances, why don't you say hello as well?
Thanks for having me, JP. Anthony DiGiorgio. I'm at UCSF, primarily out of Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital.
Thanks. And you know what? I'll say thank you to you, Dr. DiGiorgio, because a lot of the episodes in the past couple of months have been either directly or indirectly a credit to you, putting me in touch with people, suggesting good guests. So for our listeners, anyone who's been enjoying really any of the content involving socioeconomics or medical policy lately, you can thank the guest host today for giving me good ideas and putting me in touch with people, including Dr. Dahl. And so what I wanted to talk about today, and whatever I end up naming this episode, I guess we'll telegraph it a little bit for the listeners, but as much as I would like to sit around with these two people and talk about spinal cord injury and lumbar drains and perfusion pressures all day, instead I want to talk about Twitter. And I still think I'm going to call this losing my mind online, which has been happening over the past few months. There's this cadre of us who use X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, and get involved in discussions with other members of the medical community online. And oftentimes, the vast majority of the times, I think it's a positive experience. We share knowledge, we share our experiences, we gripe about what it's like to work where we work. But then oftentimes we rub elbows with people you might never meet in our walks of life, in the hospitals we work at and the departments we work in. And then most reasonable, wise professionals disengage. And in the past few months, I have not been doing that. I've been sometimes picking, but sometimes getting involved in arguments, debates, call them what you will. And I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but oftentimes you two and some of your colleagues come into my aid or defense and agree. And so I just wanted to kind of talk about what that's like as an attending, as a professor, as someone with more on the line than me, who doesn't really have a job yet. And I think the amount that I provide to my institution for the labor that I put in, I hope protects me a little bit. But Dr. Dahl, I'll open it up to you. Like, what is it like for you when you get in an argument with a medical student on Twitter?
Well, if I have gotten in an argument with a medical student, maybe I didn't even realize who that person was, or, you know, and I try to be cognizant of the power differential, right? And I certainly wouldn't want to make a med student feel like I'm coming down on them. I think what we've all recognized in our alter egos on, you know, online and on X or whatever they call it nowadays, is there does seem to be this movement that seems to dislike what we do in neurosurgery, which is work really, really hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's been disappointing to me, and I know it's been disappointing to you. And I think also, you know, I'm not just a neurosurgeon, probably even more important than being a neurosurgeon, I'm a dad. I have children. I have at least one teenager now. And I'm trying to teach them, if they'll listen, how to find happiness in life. And when I see these things online about how a resident or an attending or no one should work, I believe it's more than 12 hours in a row because it's abusive or something along those lines, I think back to my time as a resident and the fatigue, but also the incredible learning that occurred during those times. Mm. The pain that came with that process, but the absolute pride that I have of that I developed from getting through those moments, right? Like driving to the hospital as a resident at 2 a.m. in Midtown Atlanta, driving right past all the bars and seeing all the people my age hanging out outside, having a great time, going to see the 14th crack bleed in the ER. But ultimately, I'm so happy I did that because it's brought me this amazing career where I love my job, I love going to work, and that wouldn't have been possible without that pain. So that's probably a long-winded, less eloquent way of saying it than you or Anthony would, but that's my take on it, and that's why those commentaries disturb me.
Right, and I think the immediate response that I can already hear from those other sorts of people we interact with is the cycle of abuse, right? Hurt people, and someone was mean to you, and so now you need to inflict that on the next generation. And this, the one that really gets me is that medical students or residents I've interacted with, or even other attendings, have said to me, an adult man who has lived my whole life, that I don't even know how I really think or feel, that I'm a corporate shill, or that some evil, toxic culture has invaded my brain, and I don't even realize these horrible things that have happened to me. And I just smile and go, you know what? I'm pretty happy. I love my job. I have a lot of hobbies. My life is good. But some people can't seem to fathom that we choose to live the way we live and enjoy it. Dr. DiGiorgio, you are at UCSF. You have trainees. You're also pretty active online. How do these things strike you?
It's certainly been some of the more contentious debates I've gotten in online is around that very topic. And going back to, you know, having an online presence, I mean, UCSF is great. There's a lot of very vocal individuals at UCSF on Twitter, some of whom have been on your podcast as guests. So, you know, I don't want to say anything on Twitter that's going to embarrass my department. I certainly, as Sanjay said, I respect that power dynamic. But I think there's a little bit of pragmatism that's lost, and there's a very vocal minority who I don't think speak for most medical trainees about not wanting to work hard. I think most medical trainees do want to work hard, and I think they appreciate what you said, Sanjay, is that, you know, every time you don't go into the hospital, that's learning opportunities that are lost. And especially in neurosurgery, talking about practically, we can't staff every stroke center and every trauma center without neurosurgeons taking 24-hour call as attendings. And it's much better that you face that 24-hour call for the first time as a resident when you have some oversight and some backup, rather than facing it the first time as an attending. And there's been neurosurgeons on Twitter that disagree with that fact. And I just don't see how practically we could cover every stroke and trauma center in the nation without taking some 24-hour call. And you know, if we move to a universal night float system, you're going to decrease access to care. And you know, it's just a matter of practically covering these institutions and ensuring that there's capable physicians there ready to, you know, cover whatever may come in through the ER.
And if I can add, I think this actually is just the natural progression from what unfolded even when I was in residency, which was the implementation of the work hour restrictions, yeah, for residency. Mm-hmm. And I will say, right, like, you know, because I don't think it's completely black and white. When I started my training, there were no work hour restrictions, and there was certainly abuse that occurred.
Yeah.
There was certainly the chief resident in whatever specialty, maybe even neurosurgery, who would, as a punitive measure, make the junior resident stay in the hospital an extra 12 hours just to be not nice. And so that did away with that, yeah, right? And so there was some benefit to that. But I think, and the debate that we all had, or, you know, we would have over the drapes with the anesthesiologist who would say, I don't want a sleep deprived surgeon operating on my loved one. And my reaction always to that was, having trained with so many legends, was I will happily take a sleep deprived Dan Barrow clipping my aneurysm over someone who's done a half, a third, a tenth as many cases as him. Because I know, because I've seen, and now as a surgeon, I get it, that it doesn't matter how tired the surgeon is if they have extensive experience. And to your point, Anthony, the only way to provide what some people are calling for online is to really dilute the profession and to have to train many, many more people. And in a specialty like neurosurgery, where a lot of the diagnoses and the more difficult cases that we do are just not super common, there's going to be a dilution of experience. And ultimately what it comes down to is experience, right? Volume, volume, volume. There is no substitute. There is no virtual cadaver, whatever, dissection. There's no, or video game or whatever it might be. There's no substitute for exposure. And the only way to get the exposure is to be there in the hospital and doing the volume and to get good at it. And once you get good at it, it doesn't matter whether you're tired or not. It's second nature.
Yeah, and I would guess or presume that if an anesthesiologist said that to you while operating, was it a more junior or younger person? Because I would imagine an older, experienced anesthesiologist would want an older, experienced neurosurgeon operating on them or their loved one, right?
It probably was. Yeah. I honestly don't remember, because I think there were many people who said that over the years, and that was always my response is at the end of the day, I want the person that's done the most volume, right? And I'm sure we all get these questions from family members or friends. Oh, hey, how do I pick a surgeon to operate on my knee or operate on my back or whatever the operation might be? And I always give them the same answer. It's all about volume,
yeah,
right? And ask them about their volume and their experience. And that's really what it comes down to. And I think you're right. I think maybe some of the folks who have been around longer would recognize that.
Yeah, and so this is where actually I'll play the hypocrite, because even as I complain that people act like we don't really think the way we think or feel the way we feel, there is a certain element where sometimes I can't believe that people really think what they're saying. That maybe they're posturing, maybe they're trying to get social virtue signaling credits online or maybe they're trying to promote themselves and increase their following or something. But I have this new theory of mine where I've made some quadrants, and for the listeners, I'm going to make this into a nice picture and post this with the episode. But on the y-axis, I think there is how hardcore you want to be as a doctor. On the x-axis, how hardcore you want the doctor taking care of your mom to be, right? And so all of us in neurosurgery, we're maxed out on both axes, right? We're in what in math class would be quadrant one, top right. We want to be the most hardcore, badass, capable guy. And we want the most hardcore, badass, capable guy taking care of our moms.
Or girl.
Yes, of course. We're all guys in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you. But then I think some of these people we talk to, they want the most hardcore, incredible, superhuman, if it's their mom having an emergency, right? But they don't want to do it. They don't want to show up and do the work. And for some reason, because they don't want to feel pressured to put in the time and the training to become that, they decry anyone else who wants to, because by comparison, they're then outshone, right? So how do we speak to these individuals in the community who don't want to put in the time, don't want to become something great, but at the same time are trying to prevent the rest of us from becoming great when we need great physicians? How do you talk to them?
Well, I think to give some credit to that, to their argument, the argument of overnight call is not a good training opportunity, you know, it speaks to the broader shift of what medicine's become, where, you know, if you're doing overnight call and you're doing hemicranies and trauma spine surgeries and you're in the OR, you're having deep conversations with families, you know, getting them through those critical moments, that's totally different than if your overnight call is reconciling the MAR and putting colace orders in, yeah. you know, and answering pages to change things in an EHR that's cumbersome. And so I do sympathize with people who do not see the value in overnight call, because I could see if you're just glued to the computer all night long, you are, you know, a scut monkey. You're somebody to click through orders for the hospital to make sure all the coding queries are answered. You know, you're not there to, you're not learning from that. You're not gaining experience in the OR from that. And so, you know, I do have sympathy to that argument. And I think I don't want to decrease the hours of call. I do want to make a concerted effort to make the hours of call more meaningful for the people that are taking call. And so one study we did, we actually pulled the EHR audit logs at UCSF for the overnight residents in neurosurgery, and found that the person taking overnight call in a 24-hour shift spent about 20 hours on the EHR logged in. Right, so that's not gaining experience clipping aneurysms. That's gaining experience in clicking through Epic. And so I think if we can kind of shift that whole culture back to empowering the physician that's taking overnight call to actually be doing physician things and not just be glued to a computer, then I think that fixes the whole argument. And then if people really don't want to take overnight call because they don't want to take care of patients, you know, then we can help filter those people out. Yeah. But you know, I do sympathize with people that don't want to take overnight call because they don't want to be, you know, just another click monkey for the hospital, the glorified data entry clerk.
Well, as the old man in the room, I guess I would offer one slight counter to that. I would say the mission that you've embarked upon to expose that modern day abuse, right? We were talking about other abuse that may have happened in the past, and I agree with you, it is essentially abuse. On the flip side of it, I would argue it's just the latest version of what we like I went through in the pre-EMER EHR, right? Which is the whole point of taking call, and certainly as a neurosurgery resident, I can only speak of for our specialty, is how to manage your time in the middle of the night when you're on call, covering way more than the folks during the day cover, and your pager's blowing up, and it was paper charts, mm-hmm. right? And your pager's blowing up, and you know, it's so etched in my mind that I remember all the phone numbers of the wards, right, that were paged to me many, many, many years ago. But it's learning how to manage that with the real life-threatening emergencies coming in all at the same time and how to prioritize. And that's part of the process. It's completely overwhelming when you first start doing it. And that's part of, I would think, learning how to be any kind of physician, but certainly learning how to be a neurosurgeon and learning how to manage chaos. So I still think there's some value to that.
And I do want to put a pin in that, because I think inevitably part of this conversation we're going to have to talk about buzzwords, including burnout, and some of the other studies that you've done in terms of burnout and what is really the quality of time that we're spending in the hospital, not just the quantity. I do want to get there, but first, the issue that I typically find is that, as we've said, there is this very, very vocal minority, we think, of medical students, trainees, etc. Because, as we all know, our lived experience, most people do want to show up and work, take care of patients, meet them, get their reps. But it's almost taboo to say that you want to work a long time and do a lot of good work. And so the non-vocal majority often sit out for these conversations and don't want to speak up, because when you do, you get attacked by the vocal minority and sometimes even face professional repercussions. If you want to advance in an educational structure, within an academic structure, you get labeled as the person that the medical students are going to complain about. You get complaints. And we recently had Lisa Rosenbaum on in Boston, who wrote that wonderful piece for New England Journal about necessary discomfort. And that was, the concept of necessary, unnecessary discomfort, that in itself is a beautiful idea. But what really struck me about that paper that she wrote was how concerned all of her interviewees were to even talk about things in public, and the fear of speaking out. And so, again, you've got a great free speech policy at UCSF. What's it like for you, Dr. Dahl? Because you come out, and again, you don't say very inflammatory things. You'll come in and go, hey, we like to work hard. And, you know, you can't really get faulted for that. But do you ever feel trepidation about saying something in public?
I don't know. I guess I'll find out about the
once this post.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I'll find out. I think it'll be fine. Like
this is mostly neurosurgeons listening. You're safe. Yeah. Safe space.
Yeah. Your last tweet thread might have garnered some enemies.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Certainly within organized medicine. I think, you know, those that movement that you described, right? You know, the and the fear of speaking openly, I think those are two separate but, you know, concerning issues. I think I have maybe taken like sort of this philosophical bent because of what I've been reading lately. I've been reading about the Stoics, Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, and read a little bit. I mean, not a ton. There's a fantastic book with a really flippant, somewhat offensive title that I think unfortunately probably helped the book become popular, but also turned a lot of people off, called The Simple Art of Not Giving a F.
Yeah.
Sounds very flippant, but it's actually a very much a book rooted in Stoicism and Buddhism. And the reason why I'm talking about this is I think these folks who are rallying to minimize work are lost. And the reason why I say that, and this goes back to what I was saying about also being a dad and trying to teach my kids, I hope, the right things, which is there can really actually be no happiness without pain, as strange as that sounds.
Yeah.
And what I mean by pain is suffering through something that is difficult, right? Whether it's my 14-year-old trying to figure out how to do geometry proofs and struggling until he gets it, and then experiencing that happiness of getting it, or trying out for the basketball team 3 years in a row, getting rejected, and then finally the third year he makes the team, and the happiness, the smile on his face, right? Or for me, applying for this Department of Defense research grant, clinical trial grant, 4 times,
yeah,
and getting rejected, feeling that sting of rejection, but then finally getting it the 4th time. And that is what I would try to say to these folks online or in person, if we had the opportunity to have the conversation, is you will find your happiness through the grind.
Yeah, so now we know how many times a day you think about Rome. But the examples really are endless. I mean, the existentialist take on the myth of Sisyphus, where when he gets to the top of the hill, he must feel pride even before the rock falls. Or living in Chicago, we all know why the summer is so great. It's because we also have the winter, right? There is no pride or sense of accomplishment if you didn't have to try to do it, right? And so I wonder why then, because this is what, when we had Vinay Prasad on, and I asked him, is it hard for you at work? Is it hard for you in the workplace with your students and everything to be so controversial, say the things that you say, and get so attacked by the rest of the medical community? And he essentially just said, well, I'm right, they're wrong, right? And and you'd like to think that we live in a world where if you, a professor, say something in public about objective truth, a quantifiable fact, and for some reason a trainee or student or even another professor takes issue with that and says that offends me, that, you know, you're promoting trauma, that hurts my feelings, whatever, however you want to put it, you'd like to think that we live in a world where you could say, well, actually, I'm correct, my statement is correct, and then that's the end of it, right? But we don't often live in that world, do we? So, Dr. Jordan, how do you approach situations where you're in a disagreement with someone and you are literally correct, but you know you're going to lose?
Sanjay said it perfectly. You really do have to learn the art of not giving an F.
Yeah.
I was going through my phone trying to find the tweet. There was, if you're on X or social media, you're going to be called some sort of fascist at some point by somebody. I was looking for the tweet I had posted. The city of San Francisco was talking about scooter accidents, and I simply made a comment like, you know, we should really encourage helmet use for scooters and e-bikes, because we see a lot of head trauma from helmetless accidents on scooters. And, you know, somebody immediately responded saying, well, you're just a car driving fascist and all you want is cars all over the road. And, you know, and okay, great. This was what I thought was a totally non-controversial statement. You know, there was another one that in the argument about work hours, somebody posted a comment saying, well, we know you personally are one of the most egregious and abusive faculty members at UCSF, and all the residents hate you. And I was like, well, that may be true, but I don't know how you know that.
It's not true.
But then, you know, and you can look at some of the people that people in quotes respond on X. You know, I think there's a big bot presence. And so you can see, you know, if it's, you know, Jerry with like 17 new numbers after the name, and they have one follower and seven posts, it's probably a bot.
Right.
And so you really just have to not even respond to that. Just let it roll off your back and realize that there's going to be a very vocal minority of people who have these weird views and are going to call you a fascist no matter what. And everything I say I can on Twitter, I back up. I think I'm not just out there spouting nonsense to get clicks and likes. And so as long as I can speak with conviction and just let the, you know, as Sanjay said, just don't give an F about the other people that are just, you know, either bots or there to make inflammatory statements.
Yeah, but I am curious. I am not at the point in my career where I have trainees yet. I've never had, I have junior residents, sure, but they're maybe a few years younger than me, and I'm not really in a position of true authority of a different rank, but you all are. You have students, you have residents, fellows. I wonder if when you're out there in your real life, face-to-face with actual humans, and not setting aside the bots, right, but even the other people who are actually people on Twitter that we interact with who are out there working in a different hospital, I think, were you face-to-face in a room with that person, the conversation would almost inevitably play out very differently, right? So there have to be experiences in your careers, whether where you work or as a visiting professor somewhere, giving a talk somewhere, where you say something that people disagree with, and it doesn't go the way it goes on Twitter, right? So what have you had something that you can think of? Have you had a remarkable disagreement with someone in real life in recent memory?
On these kinds of topics, like professionally?
Yeah.
Certainly not, right? Certainly, I have not had that or even heard somebody say something that I thought was as ridiculous as some of the things that I've seen people say online. And I think what we're seeing, right, and I think we've seen this, you know, even outside of medicine, right, is just generally what social media has done to our society is it's designed in a sense to show you the things, the articles, the tweets, the whatever, the posts that align with your thinking.
Yeah.
And so it's really driven a wedge through society and put people in their different echo chambers and really pushed everyone to an extreme rather than the old days of the only place we got our information was watching the evening news or reading the newspaper. And so we were forced to see differing opinions and forced to engage in a little bit more of a meaningful dialogue. And so in real life, even in medicine, talking to medical students or residents, no, I don't ever see that kind of divisive dialogue.
And that's what's interesting to me, because at least in my experience where I've been for the past 5-10 years, it seems like in real life, face-to-face, interpersonally, we have become very benign as a people. I mean, eye contact is rare these days. So an out-and-out confrontation or a disagreement, right? But even we're at a conference right now, there's the Cahill debates, that we will have formal debates and it's very friendly and nice and people present research. And in the old days, even when I was in college, if someone gave a presentation, a senior person or professor might go up and critique what they presented, right? But even M&M conferences I go to, there's just not much fire or sparks in the interpersonal real life interactions that I'm a part of these days in our country. But then on the flip side, online, it's no man's land, right? It's a war zone. So, Dr. DiGiorgio, when I at least, I'll answer the question I'm about to ask you.
when I actually try to engage with these people online, the real people again, I never think that I'm going to build some bridge or change a mind or anything. I'm always commenting for the numberless, faceless readers, right? And I'm always thinking there's some medical student out there who wants to work hard, wants to be great, feels a calling. That's another dirty word, to feel called or to feel like being a physician is something special. And it drives me crazy to think that all they see is we're all corporate shills. We shouldn't work more than 12 hours. Oh, you're a fascist. I was called a communist and an elitist snob and a fascist in one conversation. So I see you nodding. I think you might have the same approach. When you're writing these things online, in these conversations, not, you know, posting about neurosurgery or research, who are you trying to reach and what are you trying to say to them?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You're not trying to convince the person you're arguing with. You're convincing all the other people that are looking at that post and giving them, you know, solace of mind, realizing that they're not the only one that thinks that way, and that there's somebody out there that is willing to post that online saying, it's okay to work hard. It's okay to take an overnight shift and enjoy your job. It's okay to have to struggle, you know, with the work-life balance. And I've had people come up to me and say, hey, thank you for saying that online. You know, and they didn't respond, maybe not even hit the like button because they're scared, but at least they saw it. Right. And you can always see, you know, you see how many impressions your posts make. I think you got, what, close to 100,000 on your last one?
Oh, I didn't know that.
And very few comments, and some reposts, but, you know, that speaks volumes, is that many people have seen your post, and even if they don't hit the like button, probably a lot of them agree with it. And, you know, so it's those people that you're speaking to.
You know what? We're talking about saying things in public online. What was your post? I liked it and reposted it, but in case anyone listening hasn't seen it or isn't on Twitter, what'd you post?
I posted, you know, and I generally on Twitter have really only touched neurosurgery, except for maybe responding to some of the people who are coming after you. But I did post something about the American Medical Association and seeing on LinkedIn a somewhat absurd post by a high-level executive within the AMA. And as many people may know, compensation for executives in large nonprofits like the AMA are public information. And so determined that this person was being compensated by the organization that is supposed to represent all of us, who this person is not a physician, the chief experience officer, being compensated in the seven-figure range. I posed the question, what exactly does a chief experience officer do?
I had never heard that title before.
Yeah, right. Neither had I until I'd seen that. And it was an AMA post about physician burnout, and in the setting of, I think you mentioned it earlier, right? Rampant physician burnout, which I think is real and deserves some inspection. What is this chief experience officer doing for us as physicians who they are supposed to represent to be, and at that level of compensation? And I guess Anthony just informed me that it's had 100,000 views.
Right. Well, so let me ask you, because this is very interestingly, all of these other conversations we've been having are mostly it's students or residents who are posting about working conditions and hours and everything. And so for me, I'm fighting the good fight with my contemporaries. If we use the language of the day, for you guys, you're punching down, or you're being careful to not punch down, but still speak to them as a professor, as a senior person. This is going after the AMA. That's an up punch, right?
Yeah.
But that's so you can't be accused of, oh, you're beating up on the little guy, but they're a huge organization. You're a physician practicing in the United States. That has its own possible political or social or what have you risks associated with it, right? So how did you do the calculus of choosing to post that online?
I think the way I looked at it, and maybe even a few years ago I wouldn't have done it, but I think the way I look at it, and again, like, you know, I promise I won't mention Rome, but, you know, to be kind of, you know, philosophical about it, right, is that I have been really, really fortunate in my career. I have had many, many people look out for me, help lift me up, help me be successful. And it's landed me in a position where I have a fantastic job. I have fantastic bosses. I have a really fun job. I love going to work. I love working with the people that I work with. I love training residents and medical students, and I love those relationships that I've developed with them. So I'm in a position where I've gotten what I've wanted. I couldn't be more grateful. And if there's something that I think is unjust, I feel like I should call it out, because if not, who am I to complain about it behind closed doors? And I think what we are seeing, you know, we were talking about physicians and hard work, and, you know, I stand by that. My wife's a physician as well, and we often talk about this, like, and she worked in industry for some years, so she interacted with a lot of non-physicians, and she often says, nobody has the work ethic that physicians do, even if they're not practicing medicine. Mm. And that's why industry loves having them, because they outwork everyone else. But what we are seeing is we are not represented. We are, unfortunately, not very well at aligning ourselves or organizing ourselves. And there's this giant organization that the entirety of the nation thinks represents us that actually doesn't represent us. Last I checked, and that was in that tweet, that it's something along the lines of 12% of physicians are members of AMA. I've never been a member, and certainly after AMA's, you know, political decisions in the early 2000s, I decided I would never join. And so, to answer your question, I feel the need to comment on those situations.
Yeah, and that rings true as well in my heart. And I frequently, when I want to speak out about something, be it where I work or outside of work or online, I frequently get advice from people who care about me, who are my friends, and say, man, just don't get involved. Don't get involved. But someone has to say something, right? Like, if you think it's unjust, you have to call it out. And even not only just, in my opinion, for that sense of personal guilt, if you're going to complain about it behind closed doors, as you said, but just someone has to say the emperor has no clothes, right? Like, someone has to speak the truth in public. And I feel like there's just been a shortage of that, at least in these circles that we travel, as long as I've been in medicine. And so I guess part of my increasing... No, I was just going to say, part of my increasing activity on Twitter in the past few months has just been frustration that, why isn't anyone saying something? Why isn't anyone saying something? Fine, I will. Right? So, like, someone has to speak up, right?
Well, and I think that's where I'm going with this, right, is I think we as physicians who work hard, and all the people that are mentors work their tails off and teach us, keep your head down, do the work, don't make waves, right? That is the teaching, right? And the problem with that is that has allowed these other forces to take advantage of us. In this case, I mentioned the AMA, but, you know, it's also in insurance companies, right? It's regulators, it's administrators, right? The rampant rise of hospital administrators who more and more dictate everything that we do. And someone needs to speak out, you know, when they come down to all of us with the latest metric that somebody who's not a physician made up, and now we all have to run around like chickens with our heads cut off trying to meet this metric, like the latest one, you know, that they came to my wife with, was the percentage of video visits that are converted to telephone visits must be less than 15%. So now everyone's running around as if that's somehow something the physicians have control over.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so that's a good example. So someone has to speak out and say, no, that's not okay. Yeah. And unfortunately, too many of us don't.
Yeah, that's like the guy sitting next to the sportscasters. You know, I watched the Super Bowl. I don't really follow football, but I watched the Super Bowl, and
we're not going to talk about that.
Right. even more than the commercials.
That extra point.
Yes. I said we're not going to talk about
that. More than the commercials, I love when the sportscaster's like, well, Jim, this is the first time that an odd number of yards have been gained in a third quarter since 1973. Like, the most random statistics. And so, yeah, video to telephone convert less than 15 is like, who comes up with these things? But I will say this perfectly does dovetail into another topic that I want to talk about before we wrap, because we have to give the devil their due, right? And these people that we've been talking about arguing with online do have points to make, right? And so burnout is real. Abusive work conditions have existed before, and we can agree to that. That does not mean that we have to agree on the root of the problem or how to solve it. So, Dr. DiGiorgio, we were talking before about the quantity of time spent in the hospital versus the quality of that time, and that, because this is what we started talking about, right? 12 hours, right? Everybody gets so focused on how long am I in the hospital, how much time am I, quote, on duty. And I think perhaps the better question to ask is, what am I doing while I'm in the hospital, right?
Yeah, no, I think that that's a great question. And it's, again, kind of how medicine has moved. Sanjay, you mentioned some of the AMA's policy decisions. I think they really have kind of shifted medicine towards us being, you know, shift workers, towards us being hospital employees, you know, loss of physician autonomy, loss of physician control, all play into this. And this is really kind of fueled my deep, deep dive into the policy behind healthcare. And I never thought I'd know this much about so many obscure healthcare laws that I think have really, you know, stacked up to drive this whole industry into, you know, an industry that is slowly chipped away at physician autonomy and physician control over the workplace. And thank you, Sanjay, for mentioning quality metrics. I can now plug my JAMA paper about the rise of the quality industrial complex, written with the current president of the AMA. And so I think that I'm not as sour on the AMA as you are, because I think that they do want to do something about, you know, this, the rise of the quality metric regime. And, you know, so going into the deep dive of, you know, specifically what legislation led to the rise of the quality metrics, and how has that been implemented, and how can we as physicians implement change into that system? You know, is it through our specialty societies? Yes. Is it through, you know, asking our representative of Congress? Yes. Is it through using our voice as physicians to publish op-eds? You know, all these types of things. And so going back to social media, when I post what may be considered inflammatory content, it really, I am trying to educate on, you know, the quality metric regime, what legislation led to that. You know, a really obscure drug pricing legislation called 340B, how that has driven hospital consolidation, and really that has leveraged into a landscape that's chipped away at physician autonomy, because now these hospitals are, you know, consolidating to large corporations, and you don't have the chance to leverage, you know, competition to go get better working conditions somewhere else. This has all gone together into creating this you know, slow erosion of the quality of work that we've seen in American healthcare. So I viewed it as, you know, being able to take this policy experience that I have, knowledge I have, and share it. And sometimes that does come across as inflammatory, because if you, you know, say something that a certain interest group disagrees with, like the insurance companies or the American Hospital Association or the AMA, they're going to, you know, they're going to fight back, and you have to be prepared for that battle.
But there's a difference between diagnosis and treatment, right? And so that the people that we're talking to, I guess, like I said, they're typically medical students, they're residents, and the complexity and scale of the issues that you're describing, again, while true with a capital T, you're correct, you've shown it, that may not be solvable within the duration of training for people who are experiencing the fallout from all that right now. And so it may, again, to play devil's advocate or to tip my hat to the real experience of them, it may be that the only solution they can see is, I'm miserable while I'm at work, this sucks, I'm not doing clinical work, I'm doing secretarial work and all this and that, blah, blah, screw it, I just don't want to be here. I want to be here as little as possible, right? And so what can you say to someone in that position? Because they still need to put in the time and get the reps and become an excellent physician. Excellent is a dirty word, sorry. But they do, right? And we're wading through shit on the job, looking for diamonds in the rough, right? So what would you say to those people, knowing what you know?
Yeah, I mean, for one, life gets better. You know, yeah. Once you're done with training, life gets way better. Even once you move through training, life gets way better. And so that's number one, is, and if you don't enjoy your job, you know, now maybe you should consider a different job. I don't think we have an obligation to graduate every trainee. And if they really are miserable and can't see life is getting better, then
maybe they should look for another job and give their spot up. Interesting, the Elsevier study we were talking about earlier, the survey that came out and said that 60% of medical students don't actually want to treat patients. 60% of them want to go into consulting or public health or administration. That's an astounding number. And I would say that to those 60% is you probably should have given your spot to somebody else. If you really don't want to go into medicine, you took a spot for somebody else, right? Overall med school admission rate is like 40%, right? So those other 60% would have probably killed for your spot. So I am somewhat harsh when I talk to people. When I talk to the med students about becoming neurosurgeons, I tell them, if you get your spot in neurosurgery, you took it from somebody else. Yeah. So you really have to enjoy it. But once you're there and once you're training, once you're going through, the grind, it does get better. And then if you really want to try to improve things for the next generation, you have to take an interest in the policy. You have to advocate. You have to, learn the intricacies. You have to be involved in committees. You have to go to administrative meetings, all the boring stuff that's really, it can be a grind, but that's the only way you can make things better, because as Sanjay said, we sort of abdicated that role for a long time. And the old saying is, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And I think that held true. And that's why we've seen this shift to, what we would all say is a inhospitable environment to practice medicine.
And I would add to that I think we, those of us in this room, those medical students that, and whoever they are, residents or other surgeons or other physicians who have a differing viewpoint, we're all the victims of what I like to call, another historical reference is this British colonial style management. And what I mean by that is Anthony actually showed me this book, which I haven't finished yet, about the British Empire and the way it took over India, which is where my family is from, without firing a shot. And it's the same idea, which is the British were brilliant at pitting everyone against each other. So we're all so busy fighting each other, whether it's on Twitter or in the hospital, it's the surgeons fighting the anesthesiologists, the neurosurgeons fighting the orthopedic surgeons, the surgeons and the nurses going at it, that we don't know who the real enemy is. Right. And the real enemy is these entities that you're describing, Anthony, right? The insurers, the hospital systems that keep consolidating into these larger and larger monopolies, essentially, to drive up their own revenue, profit, even though they're nonprofits. We're so busy arguing amongst ourselves that we're not paying attention to that. And perhaps it's by design.
Yeah. And look at, look what's happened to reimbursement over the past 20 years, right? Hospital reimbursement is up about 30-something%, and physician reimbursement is at zero. Like if you adjust for inflation, we're actually reimbursed less by Medicare now.
20% down,
right?
In the last 20 years.
And that, you're totally right, is that the way Medicare, with the budget neutrality rules, the way it's written, keeps us infighting, right? We sit there squabbling over fee schedule and how many RVUs are each case, which again is important, and I tip my hat to our specialist societies that handle that. But you're right, the bigger battle is how do we regain control? How do we fight these bigger entities to regain control, regain physician autonomy, because we know what's best for our patients.
Well, I consider it a privilege to sit here with the two of you who are willing to speak publicly about these things and willing to disagree with people publicly in writing, in record forever online. Kurt Vonnegut in Mother Night said, we are what we pretend to be, so be careful what you pretend to be. And I feel like you meet really, really senior neurosurgeons or physicians or leaders, and they'll give you a piece of their mind and they'll say whatever they think. And it's easy to think, well, of course you can speak out in public because you're so senior and well-respected, your position is secure, but having met a lot of those people and got to interview a lot of them, my impression is that they were always like that. And I think that if you have the mindset of, I'm young, I'm trying to get a job, I'll keep my head down, and then one day I'll tell them what I really think, 40 years later, you're someone who keeps your head down and doesn't say anything. And so here the two of you are out there every day fighting the good fight, speaking up, and calling things out and saying, well, actually, this is true, and I'll show you why, Well, actually, that's wrong, and I'll show you why. Well, actually, I'm a living example of what you say doesn't exist. Hi, it's me. And so perhaps as we close this up, I will put a question to the two of you, and I'll give you a choose your own adventure. Just a brief message to anyone that might hear this, A, who are the people we argue with, or B, who are the people we're writing for, the silent majority at home reading, any message to either of them about willingness to speak or what issues they raise online. Dr. DeGiorgio, why don't you go first?
I think number one is this is the best job in the world, and if you are able to do it, you should treat this job with the reverence and respect that it deserves. But that doesn't mean we can't continually fight to make it better. And if you don't agree, or if you want to keep your head down, I think that's totally fine. But I still think you should try to educate yourself, try to advocate where you can. But it's totally okay to just go to work and do your job every day, because we do need people that are just confident, hardworking neurosurgeons, and that's totally fine. But just make sure you treat the job with the respect and reverence it deserves.
Yeah, and I would echo what Anthony says, and as I've said online, you know, and I tell my kids this, you know, I don't even see it as work. Mm. Right, I love doing what I do, and I would do it for free. I hope my bosses don't hear that part. And what I would tell those folks that we're arguing with online is go find something that you love so much that you would do it for free. Right, I mean, it's cliche, but it's so true, and I've come to that realization, you know, after many years. And as far as speaking out, I would encourage everyone to speak out. And I, you know, when I get a new batch of residents every few months, I tell them this. I say, challenge me. Mm. Don't look at me as Dr. Dahl, the attending, the chief, whatever, that they have to abide by what I say. Challenge me. Say, hey, why do you manage this, you know, this pathology this way? Because I read this paper and it suggests that you're wrong. Right. And I said, challenge me, because then I'll learn from you. And so I think if more folks on different levels of this long, long path that we take were willing to speak up, I think it would help all of us. And also, I think it would help bring back the discourse that I don't think we see anymore, to your point earlier, mm-hmm. that there's people are either afraid or less interested in having a lively debate. You know, like the Cahill debates, which I'm sure Dr. Cahill would be turning in his grave if he saw how passive they've become. So, I think that discourse needs to come back.
Well said. Well, I think loving medicine, wanting to work hard, take care of patients, keep them from dying, is not a cancelable offense. And I will say that again and again and again, hardcore doctor forever. And it's not just a job. It is a calling. So thank you both, Dr. Anthony DeGiorgio, for coming back on the show. Dr. Sanjay Dahl, pleasure to meet you in person. And thank you for coming on and doing this.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Disclaimer time. The opinions and ideas expressed in this show are solely those of myself, Dr. Wang, and our guests. They do not represent the opinions of any professional institution or organization. This show is for entertainment purposes only and does not constitute the giving of medical or legal advice. Listening to or participating in this show does not constitute continuing medical education or any other professional certification. It's just a show, everybody.